From WNYC in New York, this is NPR's On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
So you've told me nothing, Judge. With all due respect, you've not... Look, this is... It's kind of interesting, this kabuki dance we have in these hearings here. As if the public doesn't have a right to know what you think about fundamental issues facing them.
That was Delaware Democrat Joe Biden expressing, with all due respect, his utter frustration with the hearings wherein the Senate inspects Supreme Court nominees, and with John Roberts, the nominee, now in the spotlight. But Biden's was a Democratic view. Senator John Kyle, an Arizona Republican, was apparently enthralled.
It is illuminating to me as a student of constitutional law, as someone who's practiced before the court. I've learned a lot. And therefore, to those who on the outside say, well, it looks like a lot of senators posturing, if they're listening very closely to your answers, I think they will find a great deal of meat, of knowledge, of the application of your wisdom to how you approach judging.
Be they kabuki dancers or law students, in the end, it was the senators who took the stage this week as much as Roberts. Was it ever thus? Or were confirmation hearings less theatrical before the television age? Perhaps, says David Yalov, associate professor of constitutional law at the University of Connecticut, but that doesn't mean that the nominees fared any better. In fact, he says, they fared worse.
Really, the fact that the presidency itself was much weaker back then contributed to the fact that the Senate had no problems giving his nominees a hard time. When you add up the end of the 18th and the 19th centuries, a quarter of the nominees were routinely rejected. Today, 12 of the last 14 nominees have been confirmed.
One of the more famous struggles was back in 1916 with the nomination of Louis Brandeis. Now, he was Jewish, and he was a noted trustbuster, an anti-monopolist. But he was eventually confirmed, and he became a legendary justice. How did that confirmation process play out in the press at the time?
Well, it played out very differently because the nominee then did not testify. Testifying became routine beginning in the 1950s. Not only did Brandeis not testify, when he was asked by reporters about his nomination, he said no comment. So it was really something that involved interest groups. It certainly involved the president and it involved the Senate. But the nominee was to some extent a bystander in the process.
You mentioned that it wasn't until the 1950s, I guess, when... Earl Warren was the Chief Justice, that nominees routinely started testifying on their own behalf at all.
Certainly the Warren Court contributed to this new and increased interest in the nominees. During those years, the court was intimately involved in a lot of issues, race discrimination, defendants' rights, various things that they'd never been involved in before. And so what we saw by the end of the 1960s was an intense interest on the part of the Senate to put nominees through the ringer because they were either representing or opposed to what the Warren Court had done.
Let's fast forward to 1981. Ronald Reagan nominates Sandra Day O'Connor to the Supreme Court, and the Senate hearings are televised.
Judge O'Connor, there has been much discussion about your views on the subject of abortion. Would you discuss your philosophy on abortion, both personal and judicial, and explain...
Why didn't the Supreme Court nomination process get TV's interest until, you know, the Reagan era? TV had broadcast the Watergate hearings, the Army-McCarthy hearings.
You know, I don't think that during that period the hearings themselves were considered very dramatic. G. Harold Carswell obviously testified in 1970, and he was ultimately rejected. But he wasn't rejected for anything he said at the hearings. He was rejected because of information that came out after the hearings about a controversial speech he'd given to a white supremacist rally much earlier in his career. The same thing with Clement Haynsworth, who was rejected about financial conflicts and not anything he said. So I think that there really was a sense that these hearings would be relatively humdrum, relatively boring, and very different, if you will, than hearings that might embarrass a political party or a presidency.
And then in 1987, there was Bork. Some say that Bork hung himself by being so foolish as to disclose his actual views in his testimony. But the left was trying to demonize him, and he had that sparse, creepy-looking beard. Could it also be said that Robert Bork was a casualty of the TV era?
I can tell you, Bob, that there was actually some talk in the White House prior to his testimony that maybe he should shave the beard on the theory that he would be a less imposing figure. But I think that you're absolutely right about him being a casualty. And what you should know is that the interest groups did play a significant role in laying the foundation for him to be a casualty. By the time Bork had come to the hearings, there were some senators that were smelling blood, and Bork engaged them.
Senator, that is... If those charges were not so serious, the discrepancy between the evidence and what you say would be highly amusing. I have not asked that either the Congress nor the courts be neutral in the face of racial discrimination.
The Bork nomination is what really kind of sent out the message to future nominees, do not engage the Senate on issues.
Now, if Bork got borked for his views, and the process was uncomfortable to watch, it was not nearly as uncomfortable as the Clarence Thomas hearings in 1991. That genuinely was a media circus. Has that affected the way John Roberts and all subsequent nominees are going to go through the process?
Clarence Thomas actually didn't engage the Senate on issues in the first round of hearings. Remember, there were two rounds. And the first round prior to Professor Anita Hill's allegations of sexual harassment were strictly on the issues, and Clarence Thomas gave them nothing. Then came the allegations.
Senator, I believe that someone, some interest group, I don't care who it is, in combination, came up with this story. And use this process to destroy me.
It's really not nominees that have reacted to what happened to Clarence Thomas as much as the Senate. The Senate Judiciary Committee after that decided when there are these kinds of allegations, we're going to hold them off the media, off the television. We're going to deal with them that way.
Let's talk then about John Roberts. In the weeks leading up to the hearings, he had dozens of meetings with individual senators who ostensibly asked him the same questions they're asking him now. Raising the question, what's the point of the hearings themselves? I mean, they're just an opportunity for senators to showboat? And if so, who are they performing for? The public at large, their local constituencies, interest groups, who?
Well, I think all of the above. You should know that very often when Joe Biden is asking a question, he's as much sending a message to Orrin Hatch and to other Republicans on the Senate Judiciary Committee about what kind of treatment nominees in the future might get as much as he is talking about John Roberts.
Well, I'm going to end this with a leading question.
Uh-oh.
Can we assume that the fact that John Roberts has Fred Thompson, a former senator and actor, essentially his own PR handler, working with him at every stage of this process, and that Roberts himself is a good-looking, smooth-talking guy with a minimal paper trail. Is it fair to say that this is the ultimate reflection of the mediaization of the deliberative process?
John Roberts is definitely a product of this mediaization to the extent that he's a very, very fine advocate for his own cause on television. The few times where he really had an objection to the senators, he raised that objection in such a polite way it was almost very difficult for the senators to come right back at him. And in fact, they've been a little bit demonized, the opponents of him. The senators obviously have to answer to their constituencies. They have to answer to interest groups. And to that extent, the media, by creating a constant focus on this process, really puts a premium on nominees who look good on television and sound good on television, and senators are aware of that.
All right. Well, David, thanks very much.
Thank you, Bob.
David Yelov is Associate Professor of Constitutional Law and Judicial Politics at the University of Connecticut.
As we watch a major political event, we naturally consider political language. And in recent years, the singular locution to come out of a Senate confirmation hearing for a Supreme Court judge is to bork.
To bork means what?
I think to attack a person's reputation and views unfairly.
That was Robert Bork, erstwhile Supreme Court nominee, speaking to CNN's Frank Sesno in July. His nomination went up in flames in 1987. The process whereby has since been dubbed borking, especially by the political right, which essentially owns the word, defined by Webster's to wit, bork, to seek to obstruct a political appointment or selection, also to attack a political opponent viciously. Not so, say the liberals. In the Washington Post, Stephanie Cutter, an aide to Senator Edward Kennedy, declared, "If Borked means fulfilling your constitutional duty by protecting the rights and freedoms of the American people, then every senator should wear that as a badge of honor." And it should be noted that if Bork himself was the proto-Borkee, then during his confirmation hearings, Kennedy was the Borker. Many personal names have fathered nouns. There's Boycott and Braille, Diesel, Dunce, Maverick, and Stroganoff, and all those compound words like Ponzi scheme and Pullman car, Hobson's choice, and graham cracker. Adjectives are similarly abundant: Darwinian, Orwellian, draconian, Kafkaesque, or sadistic. But when it came to verbs, we could scarcely find one without the suffix I-Z-E, as in galvanize or mesmerize, bowdlerize or pasteurize. Was there another name, just a name like Bork, with no grammatical frippery that was ever used as a verb? In recent history, we could find only one, to Bobbit, which means to cut off a man's penis, named for Lorena Bobbit, who Webster reminds us did such to her abusive husband in 1994. Now, Bork sees himself as a victim of injustice, and to Bork as a monument to martyrdom.
My name became a verb, and I regard that as one form of immortality.
I don't know if John Bobbitt feels that way, but I do foresee another neologism coming out of the hearings now underway. To Roberts, to slide smoothly through confirmation like a speed swimmer with no body hair, or at the very least, a nominee with no beard.
Would you like to give us an explanation relative to the beard?
Yes, I would. It's a very unromantic explanation. In 1968-69, academic year, I was on sabbatical leave in England with my family. I was writing a book. It was an antitrust book, and you may ask why I chose to write it in England. The answer is the alternative was to write it in New Haven. We went on a canal boat trip, and in the bathroom, the sink was right against the wall. So when you tried to shave, unless you shaved with your left hand, I couldn't do it. And for about a week...
This is On the Media from NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. This was an extraordinarily violent week in Iraq, marked by a series of coordinated bombings across Baghdad. It's also the most dangerous place for a journalist to work. Among the thousands of civilians killed since March of 2003, 74 have been reporters or their staff, 15 shot by American forces, according to the Committee to Protect Journalists. This week, CPJ issued a statement charging the military with failing to account for the deaths. Also this week, the New York Times reports that dozens of Iraqi journalists hired by Western news outlets because they can move more freely have been detained by American forces under suspicion of being allied with insurgents. Once in custody, they lose all contact with the outside world. According to the Times, Iraqi reporters hired by Western companies say they routinely receive death threats from insurgents who have killed far more reporters than the U.S. military, but many of those reporters also say that the military's suspicion has made it almost impossible for them to work in some areas. The high casualty rate has driven several European news outlets out of Iraq, but major U.S. outlets feel compelled to stay despite the unique challenges posed by this war. Lauren Jenkins, senior editor of NPR's Foreign Desk, says he's never seen anything like it.
I cut my teeth in Vietnam and Middle East wars of various sorts and African wars, but this is at a magnitude of danger that we've never encountered before in journalism. Every time you move, you're threatened. You live in sort of fortress-like compounds that are guarded. When you go out to try and interview someone, you've got to watch your back. You could be kidnapped. You could be killed. Everyone is happy to do a month there and get the hell out until the next time I ask him to go for a month.
Lauren, have you had to cycle all of NPR's foreign correspondents, pretty much no matter where they're based, through Iraq?
Well, we've drawn on whoever was willing to go. I mean, there's some correspondents basically say, that's not my cup of tea and I don't want to go, and that's fine. We respect that. We just hired someone who's going to be a permanent correspondent for the next year at Baghdad Bureau.
Do you foresee the day when there won't be any reporters who want to go ready to rotate through?
I don't think so. I think there's always going to be journalists who are willing to take risks to cover stories that are important. Some will and some won't, and you respect those that won't. Part of being a foreign correspondent is to buy into a certain amount of risk and danger because there's always conflicts to be covered.
What about the issue of diminished resources? How does that play into this at all?
It's terribly expensive. I mean, we've all had to invest so much in security for where we stay at night. We have to have an armored car to drive just to the airport for people to get off of because that's the most dangerous road in the country. It's costly, but it's still the biggest story in America right now overseas. It has to be covered.
Lauren Jenkins is NPR's foreign editor. Because NPR is generally shielded from concerns over profit margins that bedevil other news outlets, it is able to compensate for those reporters who declined to cover the war. But Richard Gisbert, an 11-year veteran of ABC News, says that was not the case when he told ABC he would no longer report from Iraq or Afghanistan. As a 44-year-old father with three wars, Somalia, Rwanda, and Chechnya, under his belt, he felt he'd paid his dues, and in a lawsuit he'll bring against ABC in London this week, he maintains that for his refusal, he was fired. Richard, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
ABC News declined to comment on the case, but they did tell us that, quote, everybody at ABC knows that war zone assignments are voluntary. They always have been and they always will be. Shouldn't ABC have the ability, though, to retain reporters who are willing to do what ABC requires of them?
Typically, there's been this pattern. You do your bit. You do your 4 or 5 years, then you step aside, and then they replenish that pool of reporters with younger people. And up until now, that has been an acceptable pattern for a network to live with. But the fact of the matter is, I mean, they talk about a voluntary war zone policy. In the United States, if you're based there for ABC, it is voluntary. But if you just look at the landscape in Europe, they've got four correspondents now based in London, all four of whom go to war zones. When I was there, three of the four went to war zones, and then I was fired and replaced by somebody who would.
Well, then what would you do if you were in ABC's position of needing news from a place where fewer and fewer reporters were willing to go?
Well, I'd do what NBC's done. I'd do what the BBC has done as well. I mean, NBC has hired a reporter, someone named Richard Engel, who's an Arabic speaker. They place him in Baghdad. He's there semi-permanently, does 6 weeks in and maybe 2 weeks out for R&R. BBC does the same thing with a reporter named Caroline Hawley. You can find young reporters who are willing to pay the price on a story like this. They might be doing it because they feel passionately about the story. They might be doing it for career reasons because this is the quickest way to establish them on the air. Another approach is a company like ITV News here in the UK. It is the largest commercial broadcaster in the UK, the second largest broadcaster in Britain behind the BBC. And they have looked at the risks associated with covering this war, which are extraordinary, and they have made the decision that it is no longer justifiable to take those risks, to spend the money, and to put that person in Baghdad.
But Richard, so many have complained that there's too little in-depth reporting from Iraq. Would you actually support ABC or other networks pulling out of Iraq altogether?
Well, it's a difficult thing for a broadcaster to contemplate. I'll give you that. But what's equally difficult is the knowledge that even though you've got someone standing on a balcony trying to speak knowledgeably back and forth to the anchor in New York, everybody in the business knows that they're not doing true reporting anyway. When I first started covering wars, Bosnia, Chechnya, in the mid-90s, the danger was always crossfire, collateral damage. And what's happened since 9/11 is that we are no longer merely observers. We are seen by some of the extremists involved in the conflict as taking a side, participants in a way. I don't blame any Western journalist who doesn't want to go there. It's not their fault that people are trying to kill them with roadside bombs and kidnap them and execute them on the internet. It's the reality of the situation. ABC, NBC, CBS, all those people, they provide real good security for their people on the ground. They're doing the best they can to protect their people. But what hasn't changed is their approach to staffing the war. We simply cannot ask typical correspondents to go in on the same kind of rotation into Baghdad as we did in Sarajevo in 1994, because it is a completely different proposition.
If we were to connect the dots of everything you've told us, what you basically come down to is the fact that their budgets are too small to maintain the proper size foreign cadre of reporters to continue coverage in a way that is humane and entirely voluntary.
I think what's happened over the years is because of the fragmentation of the broadcast pie, the 500-channel universe, a voluntary war zone policy at a place like ABC News, which was born during the Vietnam era when there were three networks carving up huge profits, is much more difficult for ABC to tolerate. It was one thing when you're covering Bosnia and Kosovo, which has a limited American involvement. That's one thing if you're covering Beirut in 1982, where the Marines go in for a few months, take a bad hit, then pull out, and that's the end of the American involvement, apart from an envoy that goes in from time to time. But it's not something that a network can economically withstand when it's looking at an open-ended war, 130,000 U.S. troops in theater, intense competition for the network, remember, from all kinds of news sources, not just television, but also internet. You know, that is a completely different equation for a network to deal with. Yet the network continues to have this pretense of having a voluntary war zone policy.
Richard, thank you very much.
Nice talking to you.
Richard Gisbert is a former ABC News correspondent based in London.
While at least one journalist may have lost his job for refusing to report from a war zone, another, with the help of Yahoo, is making a virtual career of it. This week, the internet portal-turned-news aggregator will, for the first time, venture into original journalism. It has hired TV correspondent Kevin Seitz to travel the world's war zones for 1 year. A veteran of CNN and NBC, the 42-year-old Seitz has reported from such hotspots as Afghanistan, Kosovo, Colombia, and Iraq. In Fallujah, he documented the shooting by a U.S. Marine of an unarmed Iraqi inside of a mosque, an image that provoked a firestorm around the world. His program, which debuts September 26th online, will be titled Kevin Seitz in the Hot Zone. He's joining us just before shipping out. Kevin, welcome to On the Media.
Thanks, Bob.
You approached Yahoo with this idea. What was your pitch?
I had been reporting in Iraq and also covered the tsunami in Indonesia over the last year. And I felt that in some ways, my reporting on the internet, I also had an independent blog at that time, was having more impact. It also became an essential tool for me after that mosque shooting to basically clarify and put into context what I had seen there. The television report I think that we did was very good. It provided the mitigating circumstances and reported on it fairly completely. But there was emotional context and technical aspects and clarifications of environment and so on that I felt were only able to be communicated through that particular blog. So that's what attracted me to the idea.
How do you decide where to go?
Well, we've got a somewhat scientific approach to this. There's a group called IISS, the International Institute for Strategic Studies. It's a non-political, non-profit group based in London. They've focused on war zones around the world, and they've identified about 31 of them. We're going to apply to that criteria, our own criteria as well, that the conflicts that we cover have to be active within the last 3 months. Now, we've divided up the world into six zones right now. Africa is zone one, and that's where we'll be going first. We'll be looking at the Democratic Republic of the Congo, Rwanda, Uganda, Sierra Leone, and, of course, Somalia.
You're going to be equipped with satellite telephones, digital cameras, video recorders, a laptop computer, and all kinds of other gadgetry. I have this image of Dick Van Dyke and Mary Poppins, you know, one-man band. But you're not flying completely solo, are you?
No, by no means. In fact, I have a mission control back in Santa Monica, California, comprised of a very talented producer named Robert Padovic, who worked with me at CNN and NBC, and a talented researcher named Lisa Liu. They are my mission control to the spacewalk that I'm taking. Now, when I'm on the road with the news gathering tools that I have, you call them gadgets, they're really my tools. And these tools have made the news gathering process a little bit easier in the sense that they don't change the dynamic of the interview as much. You know, when you go out with a big crew and you've got four people, I think you put a camera in front of their face, they become intimidated. I can stare my subjects in the eye, talk to them, and maintain a certain intimacy, which is important.
You're going to be spending on average about 10 days in the various places you'll be reporting from. Can you do the kind of deep and substantive and contextual reporting in the space of 10 days that you're comfortable with?
Well, you have to understand, with this tool of the internet, we're able to go beyond just my reporting. We can link dozens of other stories, dozens of other sites, dozens of country profiles to that region and to that conflict. They may start off with Kevin Seitz in the hot zone and end up on BBC Country Profiles. They may go to the CIA World Factbook. Those images, those threads, those stories brought together, layered upon each other, may begin to create a greater deal of understanding. Do I think they're going to wipe ignorance off the face of the planet? By no means.
War, as you know from a lot of grim experience, is no fun. But for the next year, you and Yahoo, if you were to phrase it uncharitably the way I'm about to do, are turning it into a sort of a travelogue starring Kevin Seitz, something between Geraldo Live and Where in the World is Carmen Sandiego. And when you're parachuting in and out of hotspots for prescribed periods of time, based somewhat on a production schedule as opposed to the events on the ground, how do you keep the focus on the news versus the adventures of, you know, the journalist reporting them?
To think that myself as a story could ever overshadow the things that I'm reporting on would be sheer arrogance. And that, of course, would never be the goal of this operation. I'm not so arrogant as to believe that I'm going to necessarily change the world by trying to go to these places and report on them. But if I certainly don't try, then my reason for getting into this profession was false. This isn't a travelogue. There are going to be aspects of it that people will invest in me because they may be interested in how I'm faring, because I'm that prism, perhaps culturally, perhaps demographically, that they can relate to. And if I can use that prism to make them interested in the suffering of other people, then I will have done my job.
All right, Kevin. Well, good travels, safe travels, and we look forward to hearing from you from hither and yon.
Thanks, Bob.
Kevin Seitz will be host, reporter, cameraman, photographer, and blogger for the Yahoo News program Kevin Seitz in the Hot Zone, which debuts on the internet September 26th at hotzone.yahoo.com.
War is a Force That Gives Us Meaning is the title of a memoir by Chris Hedges, a New York Times reporter who has spent most of his professional career dodging bullets. Hedges was shot at in Kosovo, expelled from Central America, and taken captive in Iraq. When we spoke to him back in 2002, he tried to explain why he kept putting himself in harm's way.
It's a kind of addiction. You know, I jumped from war to war to war for almost two decades. It was no accident that I was covering the war in Kosovo with people I had covered the war in Central America with 20 years before.
How did you justify going to war after war after war, seeing the other same correspondents there in the field over and over again?
I mean, I felt what was happening in Sarajevo was a crime. I still think it was a crime. You know, I went there because I was outraged, and the same reason I went to El Salvador when the death squads were killing 800 to 1,000 people a month, and that hasn't changed. I mean, there was a very idealistic streak that drove me to these conflicts. In Kosovo, I still believe the work that we did was good. The Serbs would go into a village and kill Kosovar Albanians and block all the roads, and we'd walk in and get it. Now, coupled with that was the adrenaline rush, was the sort of intoxication with the whole milieu of war and the exaltation of ourselves. And I mean, all of that stuff. I mean, motives are always mixed. But that's how I justified it, and I think others justified it. I think what we're less honest about is talking about how this kind of a lifestyle can become an addiction. You know, the rest of life seems rather trivial and dull and slow. You know, Freud called it the notion of the uncanny, where everything familiar becomes strange. And, I mean, you have that. And you miss that fraternity. I mean, that, you know, there is a fraternity of war correspondents. And you sort of long to get back into the conflict. Combat soldiers have this as well.
You had some turning point, some Rubicon. You decided you would cross and not go to war anymore. What was it?
It was gradual. I'm not sure it was one thing. I got caught about a year or two ago in a very bad ambush in Gaza. A 19-year-old kid about 10 feet from me was shot through the chest and killed. I lost my closest friend in Sierra Leone. I lost two friends, one of whom I was very close with, Kurt Schork. They were killed in an ambush. I mean, these aren't the first people I've worked with who died. But I think I realized that if I didn't step back and stop, you know, my luck was going to run out. Nobody stays lucky forever. I think that I've pretty much washed my hands of it, and I've spent 3 years doing that. I think there'll always be a kind of nostalgia for it. There's a passage in the book about friends of mine in Sarajevo sitting around after the war, and they're lamenting, you know, the fullness that experience gave them. They had a sense of purpose, a sense of ennoblement. You know, they were able through war to rise above the sort of petty concerns of daily life and become engaged in something epic. And I think one also has to remember that there is this huge communal sense that we have in wartime, and it allows us to suspend individual conscience. Suddenly we all know what the goal is. This is all powerful stuff. And you even saw it after 9/11. There was a kind of nostalgia in the city for that kind of glow.
Chris Hedges is the author of War is a Force That Gives Us Meaning. That was an excerpt from a conversation we had in 2002.
Coming up, why the British press keeps mum about the London bombers, and two writers who threw literary and rhetorical grenades.
This is On the Media from NPR.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations and the Kresge Foundation, investing in nonprofits to help them catalyze growth, connect to stakeholders, and challenge greater support. On the web at kresge.org. The Wallace Foundation, supporting ideas, sharing solutions, expanding opportunities. On the web at wallacefoundation.org. And the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, committed to helping Americans lead healthier lives and get the care they need. On the web at rwjf.org. This is NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. Before suspects were taken into custody in the July 21st London bombings, a media frenzy was well underway. But immediately after the arrest, civil liberties groups and human rights lawyers began complaining that the sensational coverage was jeopardizing the suspects' right to a fair trial. Unlike the U.S. press, which gave us the O.J. spectacle and many since, Fleet Street quickly complied. In Britain, sub judice laws allow for the gagging of the press by the courts. David Hooper is a London lawyer specializing in media law. He joins us now. David, welcome to OTM.
Thank you very much.
First of all, what are sub judice laws and how are they applied in Britain?
Well, once a person is arrested or charged, if you, as a journalist, do anything which causes a serious risk of substantial prejudice to the trial, you are at risk of being brought before the court and fined. And if the trial has to be abandoned because of some prejudicial revelation, the media organization could face the cost of the trial being abandoned. So it could be a six or even seven-figure sum.
And as I understand it, the effect of the sub judice laws is that when a crime is committed, no matter how sensational it may be, the London bombings, for example, once someone is arrested, what happens is practically a complete vacuum of information, at least in the print and broadcast press. Is that right?
What tends to happen is that there is frenzied reporting about the time of arrest. And what happened with these people was that because they were held under the terrorist legislation, they were held for a period of 14 days without being charged. And during that time, the press thought that it was open season. The authorities had themselves issued a lot of information appealing for the public to assist A, in identifying who these people were, and B, where they were once they'd been identified.
There seems to be a paradox that you've observed here, that the government first is issuing all sorts of potentially prejudicial information about the suspects, and then all of a sudden, once an arrest is made, the sub judice laws kick in and the press is prohibited from publishing exactly that sort of information. But there's also another paradox in that while Fleet Street is prevented from post-arrest coverage of the sort that we have seen here in America routinely, they will print a headline that would never show up in an American tabloid because it's deemed potentially libelous. I'm thinking of Got the Bastards, a gigantic tabloid headline accompanying the arrest of the suspects in the second set of bombings. Has anyone there noticed the strange juxtaposition of very inflammatory headlines like that and the total vacuum that follows them?
Well, it is a sort of British sense of compromise that the press are allowed a certain amount of latitude up to and including the time of arrest. And it's going to be a very long time before the trial takes place. It'll be about 12 months or so. And I think by the time these people come up for trial, that will all have been forgotten.
Putting aside for a moment the question of whether sub judice laws were ever truly necessary, now with the internet and the blogosphere and satellite television, for that matter, Britons are certainly able with a keystroke or two to read anything about any of the suspects or the investigation or the prosecution in any amount of detail they wish. Haven't the, for that reason alone, sub judice laws just utterly outlived their usefulness?
In a sense, if you're going and looking it up on the computer out of interest, you're doing what, under English law, you're doing what the judge has asked you not to do. And it's the sort of thing that may not play very well with the other jurors. It's the best way we know. I mean, perhaps we are too strict in not allowing anything to be published, but I think one can really test it oneself. But if one had the misfortune to be tried, I think one would prefer the English system, whereby you're tried simply on the evidence and not as a result of strident tabloid publicity.
Let me ask you one final question. At their core, the sub judice laws strike me as being a little bit paternalistic. Does the British public really need to be told by its government what it can and cannot learn?
Well, I think you're right. I think juries are much better at disregarding prejudicial material than people give them credit for. Equally, we don't have a responsible tabloid press, and if it is complete Liberty Hall, they will publish absolutely anything. So we do seem to need a certain amount of regulation because a fair trial is more important than Mr. Murdoch selling a few extra newspapers by headlines like Got the Bastards.
All right. Well, David, many thanks.
It's been a great pleasure.
David Hooper is a London solicitor specializing in media law. Turkey's geography mirrors its complicated identity. A country half in Europe, half in Asia, a democratic, secular Muslim nation with a powerful military that has staged four coups in the last 45 years, Turkey has long frustrated the expectations of both the West and the Middle East. And so it should come as very little surprise that only a month or so before negotiations are set to begin for Turkey's admittance into the European Union, the government has brought charges against one of its most famous exports. Orhan Pamuk, a celebrated novelist, is being prosecuted for speaking candidly in an interview about Turkey's role in the Armenian genocide and its ongoing struggle with Kurdish separatists. Last year, in an interview on WNYC, Pamuk was optimistic about the effects of Turkey's entry into the European Union.
In the last 2 years, Turkish parliament had changed the legal situation of the country in such a good way that all my worries about freedom of speech, expressing yourself in the last 30 years, vanished. And this is all essentially through the fact that to be in touch with Europe helped the development of respect for human rights in Turkey.
That was, of course, until late last month when Pamuk was arrested. His possible jail time raises again the question of how Turkey is handling its most public dissidents. Jonathan Sugden monitors press freedoms in Turkey for Human Rights Watch, and he joins us now. Jonathan, welcome to the show.
Hello, it's nice to be here.
Were you surprised by the charges brought against Orhan Pamuk?
Yes, I was surprised and disappointed, and yet at the same time, they were a very familiar thing to see because we've seen writers and journalists prosecuted right the way through the 80s and 90s. So it did seem like a return to the old days.
The Turkish government has always denied an Armenian genocide, and it's fought a long internal war to deny legitimacy to Kurdish separatists. But the underlying issues are all common knowledge in Turkey and around the world. What's the point of not letting these matters be discussed in public?
Well, yes, you're right to say these are the common subjects of argument and discussion throughout the world, but also increasingly within Turkey as well. I mean, there are plans for a conference about what happened to Turkey's Armenian population at the beginning of the last century. You do see discussion of this issue in newspaper articles and columns. What it appears is that the prosecutor involved may have opened this case to embarrass the government as it goes in towards the October the 3rd date, on which negotiations are planned to start for EU accession.
So this could be the case of a regional politician trying to make trouble for the national politicians trying to get Turkey's entrance into the EU.
In Turkey, historically, there is a distinct difference between the government and the state. The government is the elected body that runs the ministries, but the state, or the state within the state, as it's often referred to in Turkey, is the sort of the permanent force that is represented by sections of the army, sections of the security forces, certain ranks within the interior and justice ministries. Most people feel that the entrenched forces within the state are not entirely happy with the government's project of going closer to Europe and all the things that go with Europe. That's accountability, openness, conformity with international standards on justice and human rights and so on. These are ideas that are not particularly welcome to the people who, as you described, ran four coups in the past half century.
I'm curious to know these forces of reaction that you're describing, how much influence they have elsewhere in the civil society. I'm thinking about the Turkish daily press, which at least on the surface looks robust and unconstrained. Is there less freedom than meets the eye? Is there some sort of self-censorship going on there?
You're absolutely right that Turkey's media world is lively and colorful, but there are certain no-go zones, and one of them is the role of the military in society and politics. Another one is the role of religion in politics. Also, until very recently, any discussion of Turkey's minorities is likely to earn you a prosecution, a possible closure in the newspaper, and extremely heavy fines.
What is being said in Turkey, in the Turkish press, about the Orhan Pamuk case?
Most of the columnists that I've read have sort of thrown up their hands in despair to see yet another internationally recognized Turkish writer get hauled into court to face completely vexatious charges. We look at the great names of Turkish literature, Nazım Hikmet, he served a term imprisonment, Yasha Kemal, he served a term imprisonment, and now we have Orhan Pamuk, widely known, well known around the world, and he's going to be appearing in court in December.
If he is successfully prosecuted, if he's convicted of offending Turkey's reputation, what will happen to him?
He'll go to prison. And then when he gets out, by that time, the case will have gone to the European Court of Human Rights. And I think there's no question whatsoever, Turkish government will be found to have wrongly prosecuted him and they'll be fined, as they have been on many occasions before. I think the best result for Turkey here is for this case, when it comes to court in December, to be just thrown out at the first hearing by the judge. And that will send a message that these sort of cases, which are plainly in contravention of international standards, are nowadays completely unacceptable. They'll not be tolerated by the judiciary. That's the result that we hope for, and that's the result that we'll be working for.
Well, Jonathan, thank you very much.
Thank you very much indeed.
Jonathan Sugden monitors press freedoms in Turkey for Human Rights Watch. He spoke to us from London.
Last Thursday marked the 50th anniversary of Lolita, written by Vladimir Nabokov and rejected by five American publishers before landing at the infamous Olympia Press in Paris. Olympia trafficked in two hot-to-handle books, from Tropic of Cancer by Henry Miller to There's a Whip in My Valise by Greta X. Lolita is, of course, the story of a middle-aged man's obsession with and abduction of a young girl. There's a lot of speculation as to the inspiration for the story. Alexander Delinin, a lecturer in Slavic languages at the University of Wisconsin, announced this month that the plot derives from the kidnapping of young Sally Horner in the 1940s, who spent 21 months under the control of a car mechanic. After all, Nabokov mentions the case in his novel. The most enduring potential antecedent is a German short story titled Lolita, about an older man obsessed with a young girl, published in 1916. The author was Heinz von Leichberg. Was Nabokov a plagiarist? Or, as New York Observer columnist Ron Rosenbaum posed in a column last year, did he suffer from cryptonesia?
Well, I didn't invent the term cryptonesia to apply to this particular case. It was a German professor, Michael Marr, who was the one who actually discovered this 1916 story. And cryptonesia is sort of one of four possible ways to explain what Nabokov did. And the European press and a lot of Nabokovians are all in a tizzy because it's been played up as plagiarism. But it could be entirely coincident. Nabokov never read this story, although Professor Marr seems to have research that shows that Nabokov, in his exile from Russia, lived in the same section of Berlin as the German writer who wrote the Ur-Lolita, the 1916 Lolita, under the pseudonym von Leichberg. So it could be coincidence. It doesn't seem likely. So there are three other explanations. One is that Nabokov did sort of knowingly become inspired by reading von Leichberg's 1916 story, but never mentioned it, covered it up. Or explanation number three, this phrase, word, cryptonesia, which Webster defines as the appearance in consciousness of memory images which are not regarded as such, but which appear as original creations. In other words, one day Nabokov woke up and said, I want to do a story about an underage girl called Lolita and an older man who preys on her. He didn't realize that 10, 20, 30 years before he had read this German story, Lolita. It wasn't conscious.
But what do you think?
I can't make up my mind completely, but Marr does tell us that this guy von Leichberg later became a Nazi propagandist. Nabokov was quite anti-Nazi. In fact, his brother, who was gay, died in a Nazi concentration camp. So perhaps he did take his inspiration in some way, or at least the name Lolita, from von Leichberg's story. But he just wasn't going to give this guy the posthumous satisfaction of any credit. So that's a fourth possible explanation. But the cryptonesia one is really interesting, because when I mentioned this to other writers, or other writers who responded to this story, and the Observer said, you know, they, as am I, haunted by the idea that whenever you think of a phrase that you're really fond of and you put it in a story, I do at least wonder, oh, God, what if I read this phrase somewhere else by someone else and yet didn't consciously know it. And so I've left a lot of what I think are good phrases out of stories for fear of what I now know as cryptonesia.
You know, we've been discussing this literary application of cryptonesia, but I'm reminded of a musical one. Back in 1971, George Harrison was found guilty of infringing on the use of the melody from He's So Fine.
For that My song. Sweet Lord, I know.
The judge didn't think he was consciously plagiarizing.
I thought he was found guilty and had to give the chiffons, was it, some
very good.
Some props. And
yes, for, the judge the, didn't think he was consciously plagiarizing, and yet George Harrison was forced to pay the fine.
Yeah. You know, you wonder, like, would we be happier if George Harrison didn't do My Sweet Lord? Well, maybe with that song. But nonetheless, you know, there are a lot of works of art that depend on other works of art. And a lot of literature is made up of scraps of other literature. And do we want to, like, be so purist-minded that we expect our artists to only utter things that have never been uttered before? What is new is more a way of phrasing what is old than an absolutely brand new thought about the nature of the universe.
Well, Ron, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Ron Rosenbaum is a columnist for the New York Observer.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Megan Ryan, Tony Field, Jamie York, and Mike Vuolo, and edited by Brooke. Dylan Keefe is our technical director and Jennifer Munson, our engineer. We had help from Sarah Dalsimer, Andy Lancet, and Giselle Foss. Our webmaster is Amy Pearl.
Katya Rogers is our senior producer, and John Keefe, our executive producer. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. This is On the Media from WNYC. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations and the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people. Online at wtgrantfoundation.org. The W.K. Kellogg Foundation, from vision to innovative impact, 75 years of philanthropy. And the Charles Stewart Mott Foundation, online at mott.org, supporting efforts to promote a just, equitable, and sustainable society. Support for On the Media comes from the Lincoln Center, presenting Lang Lang, performing Chopin's first piano concerto with the New York Philharmonic under music director Lauren Mazel, on Live from Lincoln Center, sponsored by MetLife, airing September 22nd on PBS. And the Bidell Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, the John and Anna Maria Phillips Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.